Episode 178 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Instead of asking you if the crypto space is in a bubble, because I know that you and I don't believe that. We believe that crypto space is here to stay. What do you think about the pricing of these cryptocurrencies? Because let's face it, that's what people are really concerned about, is the pricing of these cryptocurrencies. So Bobby, do you think that Bitcoin, Ethereum, and many of these other cryptocurrencies are in a bubble?
Yeah, so I think a lot of these cryptos, they have, you know, the price action has a lot of bubble-like activities or characteristics associated with it. But you're basically seeing what, you know, let's call it the fair market value, or what someone's willing to basically pay for something in terms of the future development of it. So let's just take Bitcoin, for example. Well, Bitcoin can do a few things today. It's still a little clunky, right? But it's this idea that I can transfer value around the world instantly, frictionless, and for a pretty low cost, right? So that's what it can do today. And a lot of people attach value as dollars or fiat, but maybe someone's going to figure out a way to build on top of that. And it's not just going to be dollars that are being passed around in value, but something else that it serves as a vehicle for. And so I think that you're going to continue to see more code, more work being done around different cryptocurrencies. Whereas when I think about a bubble, when you pop a bubble, there's nothing inside. But with a lot of these projects, there's actually a lot of development being done on the back end to, and that's what obviously people are investing in or purchasing these tokens for, is this idea that, well, okay, it says it can do this, and maybe if it only accomplishes half of what it says it can do in the white paper, there's still value behind it because it's still solving certain pain points and frictions in whatever market they're trying to solve.
What do you believe are the seven cardinal sins that traders make?
Yeah, first of all, Happy New Year to everybody. The seven cardinal sins, these aren't theoretical. This is based on my interaction with my own prop traders and other professionals that I learned from. I owe a lot of what I know to a lot of people. But the key one that I see that's very, very common is not committing to being a professional. So we all open an account and start fiddling around. We're anxious to put that first trade on and catch a winner. We got the gambler's mentality a little bit. When you come into trading with that mindset, just accept that you're just gambling, and that's okay. If you have some play money and you want to play, good for you. But if you want to commit to really making this a profession, you have to commit to it as a professional. In other words, you have to run yourself like a business. You have to make yourself accountable to what you do on a daily basis. You have to have systems for tracking your progress. We'll talk about that a little bit later and so on. But that's the big one. The second one is folks love to swing big on small accounts. You know, people keep their jobs, they continue to work, and then they put together a $5, $10, $15, or $25,000 stake. They put it in the broker's account, they get their login, and they just want to, you know, they trade a couple times, things go okay at the beginning, it usually does, beginner's luck sort of, And then they just immediately want to go and throw 10 lots and 15 lots and 20 lots to make it meaningful, because they figure that if I can make $100 today and I project it forward 252 days, trading days a year, that's $25,000. That's not enough. I need to make at least $75,000 to cover my, it's like a very linear thought process, and it doesn't work like that. The focus should be, and this is a real sin, because the focus should be on process. Process more than results at the beginning. Then the process becomes secondary, becomes subconscious. Then the results become really important. So you got to start tracking those. So swinging big in futures especially is a problem because of the leverage. The third sin I see is focusing way too much on the technical side. So after 2009, I believe, I came online, became a little more exposed to the world from my, little dark prop shop. And I started to notice that there's so much emphasis on the technical side, what moving average works and what fib works and which pattern is best. That's good. It's important. You have to have an edge. However, how many people do you know that can follow a plan to a T in a simulator environment, trade incredibly well, and then they go live with the same plan and it just all goes down the crapper? It just doesn't work. And I'm sure most listeners are familiar with that, and you wonder, why does that happen so consistently? It's almost inevitable. And the reason is that you're focusing too much on the technical side. You're not focusing on execution. Execution is where the rubber meets the road. It is where your training has to be deliberate. You have to execute knowing that you just don't know what's going to happen, and you just have to follow the plan as it is, as you did in a simulator. The difference between a simulator and live is that your fear and greed, in other words, emotions, get into it. And so that's an area that you can try to be a technical analyst as much as you can, as much as you want. You're trying to find something with 100% probability, which there is none. But really, you should be focusing on, what is my process? Whatever that technical edge is, what is my process? The other one is changing the approach with every drawdown. So you have an approach, you have a buddy that you learn from, or you have an educator that you're following, and it's doing okay, you're happy with it, you start to trade a little bit bigger, and then it inevitably goes into a drawdown period. Everything does. Market cycles don't favor everyone. They favor a certain group, then another. And so immediately you start messing with the system. Instead of messing with the risk size and the trade management, which are the biggest components, you start messing with, maybe I won't use a 14 average. Maybe I'll use a 50 average or whatever. You start to mess with it. And what happens is you cannot track your progress if you're constantly changing your target or your approach. So give your plan a chance. If you run into a drawdown period, I suggest you either, take a pause, take a break. It's really important to take breaks in trading and just spend a day watching, or get on a simulator and do it there so you can stay flexible. But don't change approaches. Don't jump on the next big thing that some guru is talking about. The fifth is not thinking in probabilities. So I think the biggest difference between a professional and an amateur in trading is really thinking in probabilities. You have to know that statistics is based on the past. It's all historical data. And statistics are constantly being formed as you move forward. So you need to understand what you're doing in a probabilistic way. I'm really big on this. I didn't need it when I was a tick scalper, trading a huge volume. But when I moved away, when I expanded my time horizon to get out of the noise for the high frequency scalping algos, predatory algos, and all that, I had to really start thinking in probabilities. I had to understand that for a given for a given context, for a given opening location versus the prior day's open, for a given action within the first hour, the probability that the market will continue in that direction is X. Doesn't mean that it's always going to be that, but at least I understand what my edge is in terms of probability. That takes a fair amount of homework, but at least I know what probabilities I'm betting on. The sixth is lack of awareness of your own triggers, your emotions. What triggers you? What sorts of things get you to revenge trade, get you upset? As a professional trader, I mean, I've seen guys put their fists right through a wood desk and end up with a cast because they just got triggered and it just snowballed and they just couldn't control themselves. They couldn't handle it. And so they end up causing a lot of damage to themselves. And so, you know, when that happens, you just don't trade for a couple months or 6 weeks or whatever. But understand your triggers. What sorts of things cause you to be fearful? Are you too attentive to the depth of market after you enter your position? Or are you shifting your focus back to the chart or to whatever you use to trigger your trade? That way you can keep your emotions calm and be objective as can be in the trade. Remember, as traders, once we put the trade on, we have the same sense of logic in ourselves as someone who is drunk but believes they can drive. You have all belief in the world that you're seeing the market as it is. But in my experience, you don't. You don't. Once you put the trade on, you need to follow a routine, a procedure, a plan. You can't be thinking on your feet. Yeah, if you have experience, you can think on your feet somewhat. But for traders who are not consistent or traders who are struggling given the collapsed volatility this past year and so on and are looking to change markets or whatever, you need to just follow the plan. You need to just move along and follow a process, almost a habit, like swinging through a golf ball. You can't think about it too much. You just have to kind of follow your swing and let you know, momentum do its thing and so on. And sometimes you'll hit, sometimes you'll miss, and that's just the name of the game. It's just part of the nature of what we do. The last one is there's very little stick-to-itiveness in trading. That's not a real word, but people don't stick with what they set out to do a lot. You'll talk to someone, you'll go over how you're approaching things, you'll tell them what to look for and so on, and they'll do it for a day or two, and then the next time you check in with them, they're doing something completely different. They may even be fading what you suggested to them works. You're using it and it works, but they use it, it doesn't work once, and then they just go away. You gotta have grit in this business. When I recruit prop traders, one of the biggest things I try to assess, and it's difficult, is grit. I want to see your failures. How did you respond to your failures? Did you break a leg and were able to come back, retrain, and become a seeded tennis player again, like some of the guys I backed? Things like that. I want to see you fight back because the market is a very competitive mechanism and it's going to beat you down. So you have to understand, you have to allow it the room to do so, but still survive and come back and say, all right, I took my beating. You know, I'm on the canvas here in this boxing ring. Now I can stand up again, recover and throw some punches to see if I can get myself closer to a win. Those are the seven key elements that I think a lot of people just have a hard time dealing with.
So for all of the grain and ag traders out there right now that are listening to this, explain a trade scenario that you've gone through and what you've done to execute that using futures and options. What I'm trying to achieve here is simply letting the day traders understand what they're trading against.
Well, something fun would be talking about spring wheat trade up in Minneapolis, because this summer it went from 550 a bushel to 850 a bushel. And we helped farmers at Advanced Trading. We helped farmers sell that grain, the grain they had produced last year in the 16 crop year. We helped them hedge grain in the 17 crop year. And then we ask them a silly question, you plan on growing wheat in 18? And they say, yes, we helped mitigate some risk in 18. And that's just one scenario.
Did you sell futures or did you use options? How did you execute that?
We did both. And you don't have to just sell the futures in your own account. You can call the elevator and have them sell the futures for you. So you can call a grain elevator in your town and do a HTA, a hedge to arrive, and those are the grain elevators selling futures. So we did a combination of selling futures using an elevator to do it. We sold some ourselves, and we applied some option strategies that would help lock in that price, at least a floor, for which now they're very grateful because the wheat markets are collapsing across the world.
So they get short using options or futures, but they're actually long because they're going to be growing the crop. So what right happens on the opposite side of that short?
Well, you can actually, if you wanted to, using the traditional border trade contracts, take it all the way to delivery. You can send those futures to your elevator or vice versa. You could have futures in your account, and I sent them to elevators. In general, there is a lift usually of the hedge to answer your question. So we trade hundreds of millions of futures contracts a year, but very few go all the way to delivery. Typically, a futures contract would be lifted at some point, and then the actual cash sale will be made at the elevator. So no matter who you are, you don't make money growing corn, wheat, and beans, Anthony. You make money selling corn, wheat, and beans, and that sale needs to be done somewhere in pretty close proximity to your farm. Now, that person who you then sold it to can come back to the exchange and start using the derivative products again. And there's a whole list of people who would want to buy corn. Someone like Coca-Cola, who's going to use X amount of corn syrup every single day. And there's a whole bunch of people who'd want to sell corn. That'd be the farmer. They're the natural long. And then there's a speculator involved, the end user. Obviously, if you're feeding chickens and turkeys, you're going to be needing some corn and some meal every day of your life. And, this environment right now, it's a lot easier to talk to people who need to buy the end products. So I'd much rather be on the phone with one of the ethanol companies we represent, explaining to them how cheap they can buy corn or option strategy they can apply in the corn options. And then they're going to take that corn, grind it, and turn it into ethanol, and we're going to put it in our vehicles a few weeks later.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. How do you evaluate Bitcoin as an investment when there are no fundamentals? I mean, maybe you proved to me wrong and there are fundamentals, versus just a trading instrument.
Well, it's tough, but it's not impossible. And my co-author, Chris Bernisky, I think is one of the leading people with addressing this whole point of valuation and how do you value these assets. So, and he's done a lot of work, but he'll be the first to admit, and I agree with him, that a lot of this is just laying down the foundation for future work and people taking a look at this. Now, that being said, as I mentioned before, I think there are some ways to look at Bitcoin on a valuation method. So, if Bitcoin is something that can be used for currency transactions, if it's something that can be used as a store of value, you can start to speculate that, okay, if as I mentioned before, if people decided that Bitcoin could be a store of value similar to gold, and people started to invest and use Bitcoin in a similar manner to the way that they use gold. Obviously, you can't make necklaces and things out of Bitcoin, but it can be a store of value. It can be something that's referenced as value, and we're seeing that with a lot of these other crypto assets. If it can take a small percentage of the market away from gold and put it into Bitcoin, there's a valuation there. For instance, I mentioned remittances before. Okay, so if remittances, and remittances are one of the major use cases that are seen with Bitcoin, because the transaction fees are low and the ability for people to send assets cross-border, you don't have to exchange into the different fiats. It can go directly. So, I mean, people right now want to send money to Mexico. They get hit for a 10% charge from Western Union. You want to send it in Bitcoin, it's maybe up to less than 1% of that. So obviously more money can go there. So it's a compelling use case for remittances. So let's say that if Bitcoin was to get just 1% of the global remittance market, and then you start to take a look at the velocity of Bitcoin and all those types of things. The market there for remittances is about $436 billion. So if Bitcoin can get 1% of that, or 10% of that market, then it starts to have a valuation. And these valuations, you can add to each other. So if there's a valuation for it as replacing the gold market, that gets added to the valuation of it as a solution in the remittance market, and so on and so forth. And could it be a currency that people are going to use? So there are ways to value this. Now, then you can start to take a look at the size of the asset base, velocity of how these coins are being used, and all of these types of things. And you can come up with some valuation pertaining to this. I talked before, and I think the simplest thing to take a look at is speculative value and utility value. And obviously, there's a lot of speculative value built into a lot of these crypto assets. But at some point in time, the utility value of these coins start to be realized. Maybe we're seeing that with something like Ripple, where Ripple is starting to be seen as a way to do money transfers, and there's a real utility value to that coin. Well, now there's a utility value there, and that utility value is increasing, and potentially the speculative value. Now, once again, it's not as black and white as with other assets where you have discounted cash flow and all of these other types of things. So you have to kind of take some leaps of faith here with it. But I also think, as a trader, you said you were a trader, I also think there is a very interesting way to look at this from a technical analysis standpoint. And if you start to take a look at a lot of these assets, the rules of technical analysis start to play into them as well. So I think those two aspects, fundamental analysis and technical analysis, always have to be used with any asset, but they can be used here with Bitcoin. But I do agree that we're at the early stages of the valuation of crypto assets, but there are models being put together to ground this in a valuation concept and a valuation method that are being worked on.
What are you most excited about heading into 2018?
I am very excited about crypto. Last year was an incredible year, but I think still many people they were just getting up to speed on what is crypto and what does it mean and how does a bank, for example, get involved in the space. This year, I think we're going to see more products. I think we're going to see more opportunities to help shape what institutional trading of that asset looks like. And I think we're going to see continued growth.
So when it comes to the crypto space, I mean, I was actually just having a conversation with Jack Tater about this. And there's one thing mm-hmm. that I see happening mm-hmm. in the industry is we go from talking about price of Bitcoin and all these crypto assets to now the business side, I think, mm-hmm. is going to come in. And so I agree with you. I think that is really where the action comes. So give us an idea of what you see happening in the crypto space.
It's maturing. So we're seeing a lot of interest in the space and a lot of interest in the companies around the space, I think more than ever before. We're seeing a lot of people trying to shape the future of it. So this is everything from exchanges to trading tools to data platforms, and we're looking at it all.
I mean, I want to talk a little about pricing with you. Commodities such as wheat and corn, they've been really getting beat up in price. Why do you think that's been happening?
Gosh, so, you know, the caveat we'd put out there is that, you know, we're we're remote sensing scientists, and we're very focused on the supply side of the kind of supply and demand equation here. So, you know, we're not really going to be able to model or have an uber educated view on New Mexican trade policy or something like that. What we can do is kind of watch how these crops are being grown from space and kind of track how the trends in technology are affecting them. And, you know, the story is pretty consistent globally, where we've gotten really good at growing grains and oilseeds. And so, you know, the seed technology keeps on improving, the infrastructure, you know, steadily improving. And now, you know, the area that can be planted for some of these crops is expanding. So, you know, parts of the world that we wouldn't have dreamed of being able to grow soy, you know, 5 years ago are now kind of growing it at an incredible yield. And so, you know, that creates a pretty massive tailwind on the supply side. And as much as I certainly, you know, agree that there's some urgency to the kind of the longer term demand story of a growing global population or a growing middle class, you know, leading to pretty significant demand. So far the supply growth has outstripped it. And so, you know, that'll put a downward pressure on price for the near future, maybe until we come up with something, you know, until we come up with a great new demand story. You know, that'll probably stay the case.
Let's talk about MiFID II. Now, according to the media and a lot of what I've been reading, January 3rd was the deadline. But you told me when I was speaking to you about MiFID II that January 3rd was just a soft deadline. So I'm a little confused at that. I want to have you explain that. But also, if you could, give us some details as to what MiFID II is. I think a lot of us know some details about it, but it is pretty big and complex. And like you said earlier, your software helps simplify things that are complex. So if you could just simplify the answer of what MiFID II is a little bit for us.
Certainly. So yeah, those are great questions. MiFID II started in about April of 2014 as a follow-on to an earlier regulation. And MiFID II essentially took what was an equities-only law and layered that over onto essentially all derivatives, almost all other traded products. And if you think about what Dodd-Frank is, Dodd-Frank was, at some degree, the model for MiFID II. They took Dodd-Frank and multiplied it by about 10 times, and that's what you end up with MiFID II. But when we think about the scope of the law that was ratified in 2014, at the end of 2017, they were still putting out interpretations and new regulations around it. So the ability for people to comply has been significantly hampered because really people haven't been sure what the interpretations are. They really don't know exactly what to comply with. So the regulators have essentially said that they will offer a degree of forbearance to all the investment firms, the quote investment firms out there who are the European registered trading firms. The regulators will offer them forbearance as long as you tell the regulators that you are not currently in a state of compliance and are able to demonstrate on an ongoing basis that you are making progress towards complying. So is January 3rd a soft deadline? It is, in the sense that if you are attempting to comply, they have stated that they won't come after you right away.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.